Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is the Soundcheck Podcast.
I'm a self-made monster of the city streets. Remotely controlled by hard hip-hop beats. But just living in the city is a serious task. Didn't know what the cops wanted, didn't have time to ask.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. And this is Ice-T's groundbreaking song, Six in the Morning, the story of how gangster rap came rocketing out of Compton, just south of L.A., to take over America in the late 80s and early 90s is a familiar one. It's been told for years in magazine articles and rap histories, and then, of course, put on the big screen in the 2015 film Straight Outta Compton. But a familiar story doesn't mean a complete story. And that's where Ben Westhoff comes in. He's the author of the book Original Gangsters, The Untold Story of Dr. Dre, Eazy-E, Ice Cube, Tupac Shakur, and the Birth of West Coast Rap. Ben, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thank you for having me.
That is quite an ambitious little subtitle you've got there.
Well, yeah, it definitely is. But I think, you know, surprisingly, there was so much stuff that there to uncover.
Well, now that is the surprise. What gave you the idea that even in the wake of a big splashy motion picture that there was still a story to be told here?
Well, NWA members Ice Cube, Dr. Dre, and Eazy-E's widow were the producers on that film, so it you know, glosses over the real sort of down and dirty parts. And as a longtime journalist and investigative journalist, I knew that just kind of picking away at the surface and talking to everyone involved, I could really get to the bottom of things.
Yeah. So the story begins in a world where, as you describe it, you know, Compton was not a war zone. You describe it as actually kind of looking like a pretty normal middle-class suburb by day.
Yeah, absolutely. You wouldn't think that there was anything strange about it compared to any other suburb in America, but at the time, in the mid to late 80s, it was the dawn of the crack cocaine era, and violence, murders, gang-related murders were at basically an all-time high.
And as you put it, you know, the gangs quickly cottoned on to the fact that they could make money, some serious money with crack.
Yeah, it definitely, I think gangs before that, at least in that part of the country, were more laid back. They weren't associated with so many homicides, but the crack trade really amped up all that, and Eazy-E was a crack dealer himself and a member of the Crips.
Mm-hmm. But even with all of the drugs and the violence and the money and the murders and stuff, the initial sounds that came out of Compton are kind of cute, you know?
Yeah, it's very odd to hear it now, but early L.A. rap in the 80s sounds today like what we think of as techno music. And the German group Kraftwerk was very influential on early hip-hop, and this music was made for the dance floor.
Right.
And if you've seen the Ice-T movie Breakin' from 1984, you get a sense of what this was like. It was very different than the gangster rap that would soon take over.
So, you know, Eazy-E and Dr. Dre, you know, and Ice Cube, I mean, they would form NWA, but before they did, Dr. Dre was in this band called World Class Wrecking Crew.
World Class Wrecking Crew was, in a way, a lot like Prince, a lot like Morris Day in the costumes they wore. They even wore makeup. They did sort of a song and dance routine that was very electro, R&B heavy, and they even did a dance called The Bird, which was had flapping their arms and choreographed dance moves. It's pretty hard to imagine now.
Well, and you don't have to because you have a really neat photo of Dre in like a purple, I mean, very Prince-derived.
Yep, sequins.
Yeah.
Ice Cube actually took his first rap name, Purple Ice, from Ice-T and Prince.
Yeah. Well, this song called Surgery, we'll hear a quick excerpt from it. It almost sounds like a novelty number, you know, the way he's calling out his own name, and they got like a little skit in the middle of the song and stuff. This is pre-NWA, the band called World Class Wrecking Crew.
To caress your body, possess your mind, because he rocks in a key that's oh so fine. I'm Dr. Dre, gorgeous hunk of a man, doing tricks on the mix that no others can. The nurses say I'm cute, they say I'm fine, so you better beware, because I'll blow your mind.
disaster. The wrecking crew's blaster when he's on the wheels. Nobody cuts faster. You said you're hurt. You said you're ill. Well, this is one time you can't use a pill.
Surgery from World Class Wrecking Crew, featuring a young Dr. Dre. And Ben Westhoff, author of the book Original Gangsters, you write in the book that, you know, other people in the neighborhood kind of began to see him as a rising star because of this song.
He was really committed to DJing from a young age, and he spent all his time in his room. He disliked gangs. His family was moving constantly. He lived in poverty, really. But music was sort of his driving passion, and he got his first job playing at a little club called Eve After Dark and earning $50 for a night on the turntables.
Which, for the time, wouldn't have been bad money, I would think.
Definitely not. He was definitely thrilled.
Yeah. So how do we get from that to the angry, violent, explosive sound of N.W.A.?
Dre paired up with Eazy-E, who lived in his same Compton neighborhood, and Eazy had a vision for a supergroup, as he called it. So Ice Cube also had his own group at the time. MC Ren was a friend of Eazy's, and Arabian Prince, the forgotten sixth member of N.W.A., mm-hmm. along with DJ Yella, formed this group that Eazy wanted to... It was modeled a little bit on Ice-T's song, Six in the Morning, the first West Coast gangster rap song. And they kind of went from there.
You are now about to witness the strength of street knowledge.
Straight out of Compton is a crazy brother named Ice Cube. From the stupid dope gang with an attitude. When I'm caught off, I got a sword off. Kick knowledge and bodies are hauled off. You too, boy, if you get with me. The police are gonna have to come and get me.
Would they have been surprised that the music, you know, went beyond the neighborhood, went beyond the community, and became something that even white American kids were responding to?
I think they would have, but they were lucky enough to latch on to a manager named Jerry Heller with deep music industry ties. And so Jerry Heller is probably one of the most controversial figures in the story.
Yes.
He'd already been a veteran on the scene and managed, brought people like Pink Floyd and Elton John to the U.S. Eazy-E paid someone else who knew him to meet him because he'd heard such good things. And almost from the start, there was animosity between members like Ice Cube, who felt that Jerry Heller was responsible for not paying him as much as he was worth. He left the group later, as did Dr. Dre. So Jerry Heller was kind of the most divisive figure in the group. But to me, there's no doubt that he helped them their ascent.
Right. But this story, at least a version of it, is told in the film. It's part and parcel of Straight Outta Compton. But would they have had this kind of bigger idea in mind? Or was it just like, well, here's a guy with a proven track record of getting his artists money, you know?
I think the vision really is owed to Eazy-E, but Ice Cube definitely deserves credit too. He brought sort of a social consciousness mixed with a very in-your-face, attention-grabbing style.
Yeah.
Now, Ice Cube was not a gangster like Eazy-E, but he witnessed this from his South Central block and really brought it to life.
Ice Cube, take the motherfucking stand. Do you swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help your black ass?
You goddamn right.
Won't you tell everybody what the fuck you gotta say?
police coming straight from the underground. A young nigga got it bad cause I'm brown and not the other color, so police think they have the authority to kill a minority. Fuck that shit cause I ain't the one for a punk motherfucker with a badge and a gun to be beaten on and thrown in jail. We can go toe to toe in the middle of a sale. Fucking with me cause I'm a teenager with a little bit of gold and a pager. Searching my car, looking for the product, thinking every nigga is selling narcotics.
We're speaking with Ben Westhoff. He is the author of the book Original Gangsters, The Untold Story of Dr. Dre, Eazy-E, Ice Cube, Tupac Shakur, and the Birth of West Coast Rap. Lots of names there. Tupac we have to get to. At the time that NWA were forming, he was probably still here in on the East Coast, right? He moves to the West Coast in the late
80s. Yeah, around the same time he moved to Marin County, Marin City, California, across the Golden Gate Bridge from San Francisco, and he wanted to be a star. He didn't exactly know what kind of star, though. He dabbled in poetry.
Yeah.
He'd done Shakespeare. He'd worn a leotard and done ballet. But he gradually came to realize that hip-hop was the cool thing to do, and he excelled at it quickly.
So when we say West Coast rap, L.A. and San Francisco, they're on the West Coast, but they're very different places.
Definitely. When Tupac came up in the Bay Area scene, he linked up with Digital Underground, who were right about to have their huge hit, The Humpty Dance.
They say I'm ugly, but it just don't faze me. I'm still getting in the girls' pants, and I even got my own dance.
The Humpty Dance is your chance to do the hump.
Come on.
Do me, baby.
I'll do the Humpty Hump. Come on, I'll do the Humpty Hump.
Hump.
Do check me out, y'all. I do the Humpty Hump. Hump. Just watch me do the Humpty Hump.
Tupac started by carrying their luggage when they were on tour. He was a backup dancer. You can see him on an Arsenio Hall YouTube clip doing the Humpty Dance, which I recommend checking out. And he soon got a starring role himself.
So for someone who has just, you know, emerged from a cave, you know, has spent the last quarter century living on marooned on an island or something, and is wondering what the hell we're talking about when we talk about West Coast rap, give us a song that for you kind of signifies the important elements of what makes West Coast rap.
I would say Nothing But a G Thing by Dr. Dre. And the reason is because, like I said, Dr. Dre was not a gangster coming up. But he really fashioned the image and the sound that we associate with gangster rap. In the song, he doesn't talk about the Crips or the Bloods. He doesn't talk about specifics of what exactly a gangster is, other than a sort of posture. It's you're a gangster if you think you're a gangster. And in the video, he looks like a really tough guy. He reinvented himself. And the sound at the same time employs the funk samples that you associate with gangster rap, the Parliament Funkadelic sound, as well as the Moog synthesizer, the high-pitched squeal, the funky worm, if you will, that was appropriated from the Ohio Players, a group from earlier.
R&B band from the 70s, yeah. All right, so this track from Dr. Dre, for you, this is kind of emblematic of West Coast rap.
Absolutely.
So I can bust like a bubble. Compton and Long Beach together, now you know you in trouble. Ain't nothing but a G-thang, baby. Too low depth, looking over crazy. Death Row is the label that pays, man. Unfadable, so please don't try to fake this. But back to the lecture at hand. Perfection is perfected, so I'ma let them understand. From a young G's perspective, and before me better get touched, they have to find a contraceptive. You never know, she could be earning her man and learning her man, and at the same time burning her man. Now you know I ain't with that this shit tenant. Ain't no key so good enough to get burned while I'm offended.
Yeah.
And that's realer than real deal, holy feel. And now you hookers and hoes know how I feel. Well, if it's good enough to get broke off a proper chunk, I take a small piece of some of that funky stuff. It's like this and like that and like this, Anna. It's like that and like this and like that, Anna. It's like this and like that and like this, Anna. Drake creep to the mic like a fan.
Well, I'm peeping and I'm creeping and I'm creeping. But I damn near got caught.
Ain't Nothing But a G Thing from Dr. Dre, a good example of West Coast rap, which is the subject of Ben Westhoff's book called Original Gangsters. There is another character we haven't mentioned yet, and he's not in the subtitle of the book. Let's talk about Death Row Records and the one character in this panoply who really was kind of a gangster.
Suge Knight grew up in Compton, and ironically, he was not in a gang growing up. He was a football player and was considered like an aspiring college kid, so he was sort of protected from that side of it. But when he emerged, he went to college at UNLV and played football. When he came back to L.A., he sort of wormed his way onto the scene at Ruthless Records, which was NWA's label. He was a bodyguard for the rapper D.O.C., who was an amazing talent before he had a bad car accident. And eventually, he started listening to Dr. Dre's complaints that he wasn't being paid what he should. And eventually, Suge said, "Listen, Dre, you know, these guys are screwing you over. Let's start our own label." And then improbably, Dre took him up on the offer. And Death Row became almost an overnight success with Dr. Dre's first album, The Chronic.
Get your cranium cracked, step on up, and remember the name, Mighty, Mighty D.R., and we putting in work. Yeah.
Now understand this, my homie Dre can't be touched.
Luke's bending over,
so Luke's getting stuck, Buster.
Buster thought I was sleazy, I thought I was a mark, cause I used to hang with Easy.
Animosity. Made you speak what you spoke, ayo Drake.
What up?
Break him off something, low.
If it ain't another hole that I got to get with, gap teeth in your mouth, so my gaps got to fit.
They were worth $100 million or more at one point, and signed Snoop Dogg and Tupac, and they were a total juggernaut. Meanwhile, Suge brought along his old friends from the neighborhood, most of whom were Bloods from Compton, and they created a really kind of dangerous atmosphere that was not beneficial to people who wanted to make serious music. And so that's why Dr. Dre left. And then Tupac was murdered not long after.
Right. Now, Suge spends a lot of time in jail, including a kind of a long stretch in prison where he's kind of like a mafia don in your telling of it. You know, he's behind bars, but he's still running the business. He's as ruthless as ever, but he's also capable of these surprising acts of charity and generosity and stuff. You know, I mean, he's a really kind of complex character.
He is. You only hear the negative stuff about Suge, and that's deserved to some extent. He is in jail right now, accused of murdering a man by running over him in Compton last year. But at the same time, he fostered this label. And without him, we would not have these amazing albums like Doggy Style and All Eyes on Me and The Chronic. And he, you know, like if a kid in Compton asked to water his lawn, he'd give her $50 out of his wallet, and he bought all these toys for Christmas. And yeah, and there are a lot of artists who owe their careers and their livelihood still to this day to Suge.
Right. So you mentioned he signs Tupac, you know, brings him into the fold, and Tupac dies not so long afterwards. When you subtitle a book The Untold Story, people will think, oh, does he have some special insight? Because both murders, Tupac Shakur and then Biggie Smalls shortly after in what seems to be a related thing, both remain unsolved. Although you seem to have opinions.
They do. I think I know the strongest cases for who murdered both men. In the case of Tupac, it seems likely that it was a Crip named Orlando Anderson who Tupac and Suge had actually beaten up earlier that day at the MGM Grand Casino.
At while the Mike Tyson fight.
That's right. While the video cameras were rolling. And then Orlando Anderson came back later that day and committed the murder. In the case of Biggie's murder, it seems most likely that Suge paid a man to kill him in L.A. just 6 months later. And these theories are from an LAPD detective named Greg Kading. And after consulting all the many, many theories that are out there and really looking at them detail by detail, these seem to me the most likely ones.
Yeah. Although in sort of chilling detail, you give us a rundown of why these theories may never be proven, because you have a whole list of people, all of whom are dead.
Yes. The presumed trigger man in both the Tupac and Biggie murders are now dead. And all these eyewitnesses, it's kind of a combination, it seems to me, of bungled policing as well as eyewitnesses who didn't want to talk to the police.
Yeah. The book is Original Gangsters by Ben Westhoff, and it doesn't end well. You know, Tupac is killed, Biggie Smalls is killed. There's a long litany of people who are dead, who are in jail. And then Death Row Records comes to an end. And as you put it, the two white co-founders of the label made millions, while Dre and Shug basically got next to nothing.
Yes, and DOC was actually a co-founder of Death Row. And he, you know, Shug latched onto DOC when he was coming up. They founded this label with Dre. But then sort of the minute the money started pouring in, Shug pretended he never knew DOC. But yes, Jimmy Iovine was a celebrated producer himself before that.
Sure.
Who sort of took a risk when he got involved with Dr. Dre and Shug. Not only did Shug have this reputation, but Dr. Dre was in and out of jail. He beat up a television host named Dee Barnes. And so no one else really wanted to touch him. He was also still signed to Eazy-E's label. But Jimmy Iovine and Dr. Dre formed this great partnership. And even though Dre, DOC, and Shug ended up with nothing, Dre and Jimmy Iovine went on to found Aftermath Records, which signed Eminem, who became the biggest selling rapper in history.
And aren't they also partners in Beats, the headphones?
Yes, which was sold to Apple a couple years ago for $3 billion.
Yeah, so nobody's really crying too much. No one's crying poverty in that little circle of
exactly.
friends. Exactly. Yeah. All right. But man, what a story it is, you know, from humble beginnings to this kind of weird soap opera of money and music and murder. Told in the book, Original Gangsters. Ben Westhoff, a real pleasure to have you with us on Soundcheck today.
Thank you so much.
Hey, yo, I remember Marvin Gaye used to sing to me. He had me feeling like black was the thing to be. And suddenly the kettle didn't seem so tough. And though we had it rough, we always had enough. I hopped up above my curfew and broke the rules.
That'll do it for this edition of the Soundcheck podcast. But as always, there's much more to be found on our website. Lots of other live performances, videos shot in the studio, our daily gig alerts, our weekly music roundups, and more. Check it out at soundcheck.org. I'm John Schaefer. Thanks for being with us.
I'm heading for the pen. I try to find my friends, but they're blowing in the wind. Last night, my buddy lost his whole family. It's gonna take the man and me to conquer this insanity. It seems the rain will never let up. I try to keep my head up.